Good evening. I'm indulging myself again tonight. I'm reading another's poem. W.H. Auden, one of my favorites from childhood. Musée des Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Broyles Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to, on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
Thank you, Joe. May we welcome number two on our list, Paddy Dolan.
Spring song, blue skies and a warm sun, bird song, and a breeze dancing with a brown bag. Below ground, bulbs count the hours down to flower time. Let the show begin. Spring sings and the snowdrops come. One by one they appear in our world, ethereal, tremulous, whispering their promise. Life is tremendous.
Thanks, buddy. We have Dean Long.
The city in dire need of money. We had so many good players. We had such great players, Kevin Doyle, Shane Long. But the evil from the other side has taken them over. And no, there is nothing we can do. Now the city is suffering in debt. No longer in the league. They say, sorry city, for the evil has taken over and you will no longer exist. Longest Cork City Soccer Club, but only in our minds and in our hearts.
Thank you, Dean. A regular stalwart, Seamus Harrington.
Following on from Matthew's journey, not 100 miles further on, is called Blind Harbour. Blind Harbour, still dragging her anchor a half cable closer, the deep laden freighter, on this coast a stranger, off sheer headland's shoulder, drawing that extra meter lacked sea room to enter the mouth of Blind Harbour. But shrieking with laughter, Sly Wreckers that Easter. Ignore pleading father, race past me is verger, surviving narrator. Damn fog growled the skipper, first sensed the equator. He grabbed his sou'wester from hissing white panger, reefs under our counter, soon feeling our rudder, ye breaking waves mitre. At poop deck, crew muster, their courage won't falter, expecting no quarter from each shameless vulture. Invoke Neptune's daughter, stave off that grim reaper. At flotsam by water, mean hearts pounding faster, guide Reading or hamper, and high on the danger, cliff scaling rope ladder, where many a coaster, sea hound, a fleet clipper, and that herring drifter known as Ocean Venture, like fruits of their cooper, were roiled to a splinter, each lamb trusting sailor misled by a traitor, like lambs to the slaughter. Thank you.
Fantastic as always, nautical as always. Now we have Michael Longbree. Michael.
Two short poems. Standing on the edge, no closer than before, of a curve that looks over silence, where in the past there was words, until violence blew away a company that was easing deeper into me. Another line drawn from time, where change forced differences in all. Desires blank through lack of mind, movement hidden, peoples driven, blinking souls in spaces holes, shine with vitality in a new reality. This is kind of a love poem. I lost my girlfriend in this place. Settled sun stays sleeping tonight, soaring stars and moonshine bright. For now you dream and nothing matters. Solid dreams are real when with her. Emotion is whistling through everything pure. Embrace and enjoy my beautiful cure. A mist has lifted to reveal a white sparkle. Our love and our real selves shine through our pupils.
Thank you. No introduction is necessary. Nor introduction could be more promising or pleasing to Paul Kidd.
Not sure about that, but thank you, Stephen. I'll take your word for it. This is for the first bit. That's called Bridget, Queen of Bees. At the ultimate moment of conception, a meeting of ancient magic has given early birth at Inbolc to a queen bee of great breeding. Born in the smallest of hours, before daybreak, Bridget rose into the sky to meet the sun, rays of fire streaming out from her tiny inquisitive brow. Infant Bridget was fed on the milk of a sacred cow from the other world, where her apple orchard bees now nestle, gathering her heavenly nectar. When you look back through the memory of rivers, Bridget, you may wonder why the first breeze breathed about beneath a slow stretching sun, and at three when you're waving your Bridget's cross, at nine laying your brodogue on Bridget's bed, at 27 gathering firewood for the last of winter, or even at 108 dreaming of the sleeping Kayach, the birth of spring. May you be that herald of light, Bridget, who buzzes on regenerating as bees do life along the blessed banks of rivers, and hang up your cloak on the rays of the sun, for your name flows through the two brides of Cork, married to the Lee and the Blackwater, and in the Brant and in the Brent of neighbouring Wales and England. You are named Bridget for a poet, worshipped by poets in the oral tradition. Bride in Scotland, Brigitte en France, Brigantia in England and Spain, Side in Wales, Brie on the Isle of Man, Breeder, Breed, Bridie, Brigida, Brig, Brigandu, all from a Celtic name, Breosoet, Bright Arrow, Bright One, Powerful One, High One, a fiery arrow let loose by the royals of the Tuatha Dé Danann. Her mother, you should know, is the Morrigan, herself a triple goddess of high renown. Her daddy is the Dagda, the patriarch of Celts, for 80 years the High King of Ireland. Bridget is sister to Rhiannon, the horse goddess, Epona, sister to Baib, the war goddess, sister to Ogma, the god of eloquence, music, magic, and poetry. Sister also to Bob Dark and Midir, the gods of war and the underworld. Half sister to Angus Oak, the god of youth. Sister to us all. Unlike other triple goddesses, as in the Greek tradition where she is maiden, matron, and crone, virgin, mother, and hag, Irish Breed is a triple goddess of fire. Bridget, fire of the hearth, is goddess of fertility, childbirth, and all healing. Bridget, fire of the forge, is goddess of weaving, embroidery, and smithing. A goddess imbued, a glowing goddess imbued, shining with justice, law, and order. Bridget, fire of inspiration, is the muse of poetry, history, and song, the protector of all cultural learning, a goddess of most high things, of high rising flames, of highlands and hill forts, of wisdom, excellence, perfection, of intelligence, druidry, and warfare. Her name was given to the saint, for she is a goddess of light, of compassion, of inspiration. Once foster mother, it is said, to the infant Jesus. One day, Bridget, you may find in you an affinity to the vibrant spirits of fire, to sparks, sudden flames, to shooting stars, to night lights, candles, and sunrise. You may begin one day, Bridget, to hear the memories of springs and wells, of poetry, whistling, embroidery, of bells, thresholds, and doorways. You may well find yourself dreaming, Bridget, of lambs, dairy cows, and cockerels, of owls, serpents, and bees, and of creatures waking from hibernation. For Bridget heralds the first day of spring, the milk of pregnant ewes, the sacredness of motherhood, the very life force sustained and nourished. For Bridget is trailed lightly by spirits of acorn and oak, of dandelion, the triplet petals of snowdrops, crocus, and trillium, the nourishing promise of oats, pumpkin, and corn. For Bridget dances in the scent of heather, of wisteria, violets, and lavender, of lemon beebrush, heliotrope, and chamomile daisies, of anemone coronaria, broom, shamrock, rushes, sage, and straw. For all the field's flowers, Bridget draws light from gold, silver, carnelian, from agate, copper, and amethyst, from jasper, and lapis lazuli crystal, to bring brightness wherever you go. For wherever you live, there is light, Bridget. Yes, you are the dawn of warmth, the keeper of bees, the slow dilating strength of the sun.
Thank you, Paul. And the man to follow that is John Wren.
I grew up in a village by the side of the road. and there was two old cottages, old side cottages. I lived in one of them, and behind us was basically beans and grass and silage and all that sort of stuff. Now, it's, a few years ago that those two houses were knocked, and they built a new estate in the back. It was with nine houses, and they just called it the new houses. And unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, a guy was stabbed to death there. And this is a response to the emotions that come from something like that, and it's about the release of emotions, really. And I call it a threshold, but it's really a tribute to the people of Latin. A threshold. Many the hamlet strewn along secondary routes. Now, as I remember, just one, a spot so often skimmed by wind and traffic. It seems far in the past, this particular point, with neighbourhood values no worse than anywhere else. As my mind revisits, all I can see is youthful, regular, ordinary experience. Listless hours I passed there with nothing worth questioning. A visitor could pass many days there, far away from world events. Two small plots of grass lay behind two old houses, little new for a long time. But a stranger now appears, on foot of an experience, to record a mixed metaphor and put it in a box. Beside him, a panning camera attempts to explain all of a community in a quick few images. The expert communicator, full of reusable jaded phrases, indicates the cold chronology. Time, date, two people, doom and despair. When the old homesteads were knocked, they built a cluster of new houses. Good. And little may have shook the young or the rest of us. Destiny and hazard collided and deluded us. Where once an old threshold divided roadside emptiness, now a covered pavement stains with an unfamiliar colour. Unseen, a pain released in the proud hearts of a people so strained. Now a sorrow pours on the heads of many. Seasons will pass, and the sad feelings and happy memories and indifferent weeks will blend together with fits of forgetfulness and jumbles of recollection. This traditional benefit is not to be scorned by the passive onlooker. For how is the security of local priority to be bettered by mobile experts? Yet now and for many a month, families will be covered by the heavy drapes of regret and grief. Heritage may be the act of bearing up long after the departure of finger-waving, malicious commentators and the empty cynicism of interfering gazers. The wider world will convulse while the local place marks time. The historic moments of tragedy etched into the landscape, along with the good, and the people carry on. They must. Certain, the locality's lungs will breathe as a wind again, skips through the threshold of a forgotten cottage. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now shall we welcome with rapturous an orgasmic applause our five-word champion, Mark Noonan.
Alright, thank you. I'm going to read a poem about, an event that happened about 3 or 4 years ago that just confused the hell out of me ever since. It's called Get Those Feet Moving. Feet have been turning up on the shores of Canada. Nobody's doing anything about it. Whose feet? We don't keep files of tokens. There's a killer out there, cutting people's feet off and throwing them into the Pacific Ocean, like you throw a stick for a dog. Maybe he's got a dog. Maybe, look, feet are turning up in the real world. This is real life we're talking about. Somebody is doing something terrible. Why am I not all on this feet thing? Are they found in twos or is it mix and match? Is it somebody's job in Canada to compare all the feet and see which ones are related? If he can't get a pair, does his friend tell him to go fish? These are all men in my imagination. We were not involved in things like feet turning up. But his penis is now. There you go.
Yeah.
But it's feet. Actually, there have only been 5 human feet found. 4 right feet and 1 left foot. And 1 further foot, that of an animal thrown into a shoe. All the rest are in shoes too. The animal one was a hoax. Animals don't wear shoes. Now they're saying it might be natural on the news, that these feet don't look like they were removed by force. Did they just fall off then? Everybody check your feet. This is real. People are finding feet on the beach in Vancouver. If you get less than 2 when you count your feet, one of these found feet might belong to you. But a body at sea for a long time will separate, they say, naturally. Is the shoe, is the rubber soles trainer more buoyant than a free floating hand or a head? They're blaming the tsunami now for these feet. Maybe the shod foot is the only part of a human corpse unappealing to sea turtles. That's another possibility. I just can't get my head around these feet.
The next person needs no introduction. She's a regular. She's a pillar of this institution. Patricia.
Thank you for the rapid introduction. Let's read two poems of kind of crackling on. This one is called Nuclear Winter. I once read your manifesto in a serial manifestation in which you argued you could save the universe by way of a parallel Earth and change for the better the cosmos as we know it. Although the magic in my life is mundane enough to attenuate your ideas, maybe a parallel universe indeed is what it takes to reduce our temple conflict to a gift-wrapped concrete box interred Susie deep in precious silence. And this one's called Defining the Relationship, or as Americans among you would say, DTR. Defining the Relationship. The bad postman dropped the bell, not for my own sake, but for the sake of those sleeping on whom I throw my mercy. I slide the chain and for his efforts say nothing. You say, this DTR. You want answers, those that only I can produce, and only ones that you have sucked out by wet-eyed wisdom of post-midnight oil. You try to commend yourself to sleep. Having failed, you steal my slumber. As Colombo said, just one more thing, your sore eyes declare the question. Did you ever really love me? You being 20 inches from my person, as close as you'll ever be. Consummating fantasies, waking roses with just shock. Now even take the time to slam the door behind you, and everyone helps you sleep.
May I welcome Fintan Brady. He is amongst us. And there he comes. And he's got a song with him too. Sure. Fintan Brady.
Thank you.
The pressure that is on and was on, I'm not sure if it's still going on, Japanese students not to lose face and to perform well in their studies. And there was a phenomenon that emerged which was called Hikikomori syndrome, where they would go away and lock themselves in their bedrooms rather than face the world, because it was just too much for them. So I wrote this little piece called Hikikomori Syndrome. brakes screech in the Tokyo night, scraping the inside of his skull, empty of answers he needed to find in the crowded exam hall. At the house, he shoves past his mother, too stunned by his look to utter a word, hurries upstairs, locks himself in, turns his back on the world. Relief as the knocking subsides, her footsteps so light on the floor. Shame when he finds the noodles and fish she has left at his door. For months in his self-imposed jail, stale air, fetid breath, with no sky, he is mocked by a yellowing blotch on the ceiling that keeps catching his eye. Poleaxed by day, blinking at night, at wavering clusters splutter the screen. He is held by image, motion and light, joystick his only control. Earnest, methodical, forced to compete, he watches his father's dreams taken apart. Loss of face is his choice, the stylite who keeps himself hidden from brightness and noise.
Now, unfortunately, Dáil Harding has to follow Mary O'Connell. The poor man. Let's all say a prayer for him. Dáil.
There was a few poems tonight about the British Day. That was called. Anyway, there's on my place, there's forest bushes around the house, and the biggest day of the year is when the seed pods crack on the furs. That means that it's really summer, it's high summer. So it's something to look forward to. We didn't have it for about 4 years. This is called Furs. When I hear that seed bud crack upon a summer day, I know I should bend down and kiss the ground. Here is high summer now. This is the moment. There is no wind. In the field, the cows are motionless. There is a low murmur from bees in the hedge. Through the heat haze, I decipher a gannet gliding. The beetle scurries along the dusty path. The swallow jets by. The purple berries will soon beg for picking. A goldfinch rainbows by. Soon the light will be tricking, inviting the bats, the butterfly in haste. Their supper time is short. They have no time to waste. Thanks.
This man here on the list who is known only by the name of Aaron. He has no surname, he has no past, he has no future. But amongst us now, can we invite Aaron? Aaron!
My name is Aaron, but anyway. Yeah, like Puff Aaron.
Conquering the world, one blue model at a time.
Love, the deepest expression of our soul's song. The heart aligns itself with the deepest truth. We move ever deeper into the moment. As we give thanks for the life we live, the universe cradles us in silken fabrics. We walk barefoot in the dark forest, the flow of dreams ever guiding us home. I lie here on a bed of rose petals, ever giving thanks for love's power. It will bring tears to men of strength. As we attune ourselves to love's cosmic vibration, our souls become one. Before I fell asleep last night, I read a Rumi poem which I loved, and this is called Enough Words. How does the part of the world leave the world? How can wetness leave water? Don't try to put out the fire by throwing on more fire. Don't wash a wound with blood. No matter how fast you run, your shadow more than keeps up. Sometimes it's in front. Only full overhead sun diminishes your shadow. But what shadow has been serving you? What hurts you, blesses you? Darkness is your candle. Your boundaries are your quest. I can explain this, but it would break the glass cover on your heart, and there's no fixing of that. You must have shadow and light source both. Listen and lay your head under the tree of awe. When from that tree feathers and wings sprout on you, be quieter than a dove. Don't open your mouth for even a cue. When a frog slips into water, the snake cannot get it. Then the frog climbs back out and croaks, and the snake moves towards him again. Even if the frog learned to hiss, still the snake would hear through the hiss the information he needed, the frog's voice underneath. But if the frog could be completely silent, then the snake would go back to sleeping, and the frog could reach the body. The soul lives there in that silent breath, and that grain of barley is such that when you put it to the ground, it grows. And these enough words, or shall I squeeze more juice from this? Who am I, my friend?
Some people are just born or christened with beautiful sounding names, but the next person, his name, he is lucky enough to be called Andrew Das Moon. Andrew Das Moon.
Thank you for that introduction. I thank my parents. So I'll try and follow the Rumi, and this is a poem that drifted along to me. It's called Blue Moon River. The river, dark and swollen, glides silently through the evening city, licking cold the underneath of bridges and passing on to freeze reflections of streetlights in its tarn-like surface, primordial. It has done this for quite some time now, before streetlights and bridges, before city and me, this blue moon river in spring.
I'm not sure if this institution that we have here in the true pocket, and everybody's contributed, has ever grown someone. But if it has grown someone, I think maybe one seed of this place has been caught. Can we welcome a very embarrassed Colin Scully? I'll just give a small introduction for this poem. It's a poem about language,
and then try to summarize what it's about. As well, it's thinking about the way we as humans think, and you know, the way, you know, I suppose humans try to they like to equate things like leaves. They like to say two leaves. They like to say compare them, even though in reality, in nature, two leaves obviously can never be the same. And they also like to decide which leaf is the most beautiful, and because of that, they use things like superlatives. And basically, this poem is just about superlatives and the way we use superlatives, and the way to, you know, why superlatives have arisen, the most beautiful scenery, the finest poem, the fastest man, and I just feel that in nature and in reality, superlatives don't really exist, yet we as humans use superlatives in everyday language and in poetry and in literature to describe all of the time, because it simplifies the way we think about the world. We like to use superlatives. So I think superlatives really kind of they say something more about us and our minds rather than about the world that they're meant to be describing. So this is the poem. It's called The Origin of Superlatives. And but if these words and a dozen others, positioned in places of importance leading to ambiguity. And was the first word double its meaning, but was the second half in its worth. If a reaction to the preceding dilemma, this contortion of letters gave the axis their birth. Initially, three axes was considered sufficient. Sufficient hold and but if within its grasp. But what circumstances were to change? And not reassert themselves. R was enlisted to take on the task. Words like, because, maybe, even, gradually cluttered the spatial domain until one day, in a last ditch effort to simplify the system, down from the dreamers, superlatives came.
Before we invite along our last reader and last contributor, there's people that we need to thank. And the first person we need to thank is Matthew. For coming here and being a contributor. The second person we need to thank is you yourselves for just contributing and being here. And you deserve a round of applause for yourselves. The next person we need to applaud is the person who gives us drink, which supplies us with so much inspiration, and that's B. And as we draw to a close in our usual format, we need to thank the net final contributor, which is generally and usually talented.
Yay!
And of course we should thank Stephen as well. Growing in the job, he's actually fucking enjoying it, you know.
Anyway,
to finish off, I've had the fortune as a Cotter knows to be invited along with Billy Rams and others to the Shanghai Literary Festival. This is Paul. And I have never that interest in the Far East, but I did write a story about the wisdom of the Far East, which is called The Brotherhood of Wisdom. So if you bear with me for a little while, it's about wisdom, which is a good way to finish the night anyway. Once upon a time, in a kingdom in which there were no newspapers, lived a man who wished to acquire wisdom. He spent all of his time from the breaking of the day to the making of the night, travelling around to the bearded wise ones who wore sandals and spoke in cryptic monosyllables. He sat at their feet and drank deeply of the words which fell from their mouths. He read all the great manuscripts and great books of wisdom in the great libraries of that great kingdom. He was awarded high honours in the public examinations for degrees and diplomas in wisdom, and wore the red robes of those who had successfully completed their studies in wisdom accordingly. He was rightly and justly and neatly proud of his achievements in wisdom studies. It's all right, I teach in UCC. He attended wisdom conferences in many parts of the world and wrote wisdom monographs with neatly arranged footnotes which were always consistent in style and layout. Despite this, however, and despite the kinds of kudos, at least, which he got at dinner parties and fancy receptions when people asked him what his field of expertise was, and he could answer with a knowledge shrug, well, wisdom, actually. Despite all this, he desperately wished to be accepted into the Brotherhood of Wisdom, so that he could spend the rest of his mortal days listening to those whose every thought sprang from the wellsprings of inspiration and whose every moment was founded in the well fount of truth. He spent 40 days crossing the desert on a horse with no name, and it was good to be out of the rain, even if he only ate withered figs and drank camel piss. In the end, he reached the monastery of the Brotherhood of Wisdom, somewhere between the sea and the mountains. He was allowed in and asked all the hard questions. And he had all the answers. He sang for them the psalms of the prophets and sighed the sayings of the seers and mumbled the mantras of the mysterious. He gave out bits of the silver apples of the moon and put before them chunks of the golden apples of the sun. He spoke of the ox of the seven combats and refuted the beasts out of Anima Mundi. All this and much more he knew in his head because he had cogitated thereupon and had gained first-class honours in his examinations in the study of wisdom. Very well then, said the carbuncular abbot, it doth appear that you know it all. But there is yet one more test that you have to do, one more trial for you to essay before you are allowed into the Brotherhood of Wisdom. Come hither. And the man went unto him very quickly indeed, and with great eagerness, and the abbot looked down into his throat. Mm-hmm, he said, whilst he thought and looked and produced the lighted reed which was always on hand on occasions like this. He plunged the reed down the man's throat, and when he withdrew it, it was utterly quenched. You fail, said the abbot very roughly. Depart and remove and vanish from this place and out of my sight. But, the man said a few more times, I've all the knowledge. I've read all the books. I've answered all the questions. I've supped at the feet of the wise. I've followed all the instructions. I've completed all my courses and gained all my degrees, diplomas and certificates with the highest of distinctions and merits and honours. Why then are you banishing me? Because you have no wick, said the abbot. And then the man picked up his bags and went away, and his heart was heavy and sore. And as he crossed the bridge, it gave way and he fell down into the rushing stream. And he drowned therein because he could not swim with the weight which he carried in his soul.
And unless there's another poet amongst you, we should go drink in the crane then.
Alan's got a song.
Excellent.
Well, we got one more. Alan Coffey. You wouldn't. We know we wouldn't do it. Alan Coffey. Alan Coffey. What? Thank you.
it. It's a acres of and despair, and Farraga Moore agree, Alling, Murim Pilarum. I'm gonna go.